White tracked down the insurance salesman who had originally sold Roan the policy in 1921. Hale had always insisted that Roan, one of his closest friends, had made him the beneficiary because he had lent Roan a lot of money over the years. But the salesman told a different story. As the salesman recalled it, Hale had independently pushed for the policy, saying, "Hell's bells, that's just like spearing fish in a keg." Hale had promised to pay an extra premium on such a policy, and the salesman had responded, "Well, we might write him for $10,000. "No, I want it for $25,000," Hale said. The salesman had told Hale that because he wasn't Roan's relative, he could become his beneficiary only if he were his creditor. Hale had said, "Well, he owes me a lot of money. He owes me $10,000 or $12,000." White found it hard to believe that this debt was real. If Roan had really owed Hale that amount of money, then all Hale would have had to do was present proof of the debt to Roan's wealthy estate, which would have reimbursed him. Hale had no need to get an insurance policy on his friend's life, a policy that wouldn't have a significant return unless Roan, who was then in his late 30s, suddenly died. The salesman, who was close to Hale, admitted that he had no proof of the debt and that he had simply desired his commission. He was yet another person bound up in the Indian business. Roan seemed to have been unaware of these machinations. He trusted that Hale, his supposedly closest friend, was helping him. But there remained one impediment to Hale's scheme. A doctor had to examine Roan, a heavy drinker who had once wrecked his car while intoxicated, and deem him a safe risk for the insurance company. Though one physician said that nobody would approve that drunken Indian, Hale shopped for doctors until he found a man named Paul Huskill willing to recommend Roan. One of the seemingly ubiquitous Schoen brothers, James, also recommended Roan. White discovered that the insurance company had rejected the first application. A company representative later noted dryly of Hale's effort to secure a $25,000 policy, "I don't think it would seem regular." Undeterred, Hale approached a second insurance company. The application asked if Roan had previously been turned down by a competitor. The answer, "No," was filled in. An insurance agent who reviewed the application later told authorities, "I knew the questions in it had been answered falsely." This time, Hale had produced a creditor's note to prove that he was owed money by Roan. The debt that Hale had originally claimed, $10,000 or $12,000, had grown inexplicably to $25,000, the exact amount of the insurance policy. The creditor's note was purportedly signed by Roan and was dated J.A.N.Y. 1921. This was important because it indicated that the note predated efforts to obtain the insurance, giving legitimacy to Hale's claim. Handwriting and document analysis were emerging tools in the field of criminal investigation. Although many people greeted the new forensic sciences with reverence, attributing to them a godlike power, they were often susceptible to human error. In 1894, the French criminologist Bertillon had helped to wrongfully convict Alfred Dreyfus of treason, having presented a wildly incorrect handwriting analysis. But, when applied carefully and discreetly, document and handwriting analysis could be helpful. In the infamous Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb murder case in 1924, investigators had correctly detected similarities between Leopold's typed school notes and the typed ransom note. Agents working on Roan's murder case later showed the creditor's note to an analyst at the Treasury Department, who was known as the Examiner of Questioned Documents. He detected that the date initially typed on the document had said June, and that someone had then carefully rubbed out the U and the E. Photographs taken by means of slanting light show clearly the roughening and raising of the fibers of the paper about the date, due to mechanical erasure, the examiner wrote. He determined that somebody had replaced the U with an A and the E with a Y so that the date read J-A-N-Y, January. White suspected that Hale had ginned up the document while trying to obtain the insurance policy, and altered it after realizing that he had blundered on the date. Later, a federal official questioned the man who Hale claimed had typed up the note. He denied ever having seen the document. Asked if Hale was lying, he said, absolutely. The second insurance company approved the policy after Hale took Roan to the Pawhuska doctor again for the required medical examination. The doctor recalled asking Hale, Bill, what are you going to do, kill this Indian? Hale, laughing, said, hell yes. After Hale served as a pallbearer at Roan's funeral, White learned, local lawmen did more than ignore Hale as a suspect. They tried to build a case against Roy Bunch, the man who'd been having an affair with Roan's wife. White and his agent spoke to Bunch, who maintained his innocence and told a curious story about Hale. After Roan's murder, Hale had approached Bunch and said, if I were you, I'd get out of town.
Why should I run? I didn't do it.
People think you did, Hale said. He offered Bunch money to help him flee. Afterward, Bunch spoke to a friend who persuaded him not to take off because it would only make him look guilty. If you run, they'll hang it on you for sure, his friend said. White and his men thoroughly investigated Bunch and ruled him out as a suspect. As one agent noted, the notorious relations between Bunch and Roan's wife were calculated to furnish a good screen for the real murderers. And the person who seemed most intent on framing Bunch was the king of the Osage Hills. After Roan's murder, Hale had visited Roan's widow several times to try to get her to sign various papers regarding claims against Roan's estate. Once, Hale had left a bottle of whiskey for her as a gift, but she refused to taste the moonshine. She feared that it was poison. Though White had gathered circumstantial evidence implicating Hale in the murder of Roan, there were still huge holes in the case. There was no proof, no fingerprints, no credible eyewitnesses, that Hale had shot Roan or that he had ordered one of his nephews or another henchman to do so. And while the suspicious life insurance policy seemed to tie Hale to Roan's murder, it did not provide a motive for the other Osage killings. Yet, as White studied the Roan case further, one detail stood out. Before Hale obtained the life insurance policy on Roan, he had attempted to purchase Roan's headright, his share in the tribe's mineral trust, which was more precious than any cash of diamonds or gold. Hale knew that the law prevented anyone from buying or selling a headright, but he'd been confident that lobbying pressure from influential whites would soon eliminate this prohibition. Indeed, Hale once said, I, like many other good men, believed it would be only a short time until Congress would pass a law permitting every educated Indian who had his certificate of competency to sell or convey his or her mineral rights to whom they wished. Yet the law had not been changed, and White suspected that this setback had prompted Hale to turn to the insurance murder plot. There was one legal way, though, that someone could still obtain a headright. Inheritance. As White examined probate records for many of the murder victims, it was evident that with each successive death, more and more headrights were being directed into the hands of one person, Molly Burkhart. And it just so happened that she was married to Hale's nephew, Ernest, a man who, as an agent wrote in a report, is absolutely controlled by Hale. Kelsey Morrison, the bootlegger and bureau informant, said to agents that both Ernest and Brian Burkhart did exactly what their uncle told them to do. Morrison added that Hale was capable of anything. White studied the pattern of deaths in Molly's family. Even the chronology no longer seemed haphazard, but was part of a ruthless plan. Anna Brown, divorced and without children, had bequeathed nearly all her wealth to her mother, Lizzie. By killing Anna first, the mastermind made sure that her headright would not be divided between multiple heirs. Because Lizzie had willed most of her headright to her surviving daughters, Molly and Rita, she became the next logical target. Then came Rita and her husband, Bill Smith. White realized that the unusual method of the final killing, a bombing, had a vicious logic. The wills of Rita and Bill stipulated that if they died simultaneously, much of Rita's headright would go to her surviving sister, Molly. Here, the mastermind had made one miscalculation. Because Bill unexpectedly outlived Rita by a few days, he had inherited much of her wealth, and upon his death, the money went to one of his relatives. Still, the bulk of the family's head rights had been funneled to Molly Burkhart, whose wealth was controlled by Ernest. And Hale, White was convinced, had secretly forged an indirect channel to this fortune through his subservient nephew. As White later reported to Hoover, Molly appears to have been the first means to draw Hale through the Burkharts, the assets of the entire family. White couldn't determine whether Ernest's marriage to Molly 4 years before Anna's murder had been conceived from the outset as part of the plot, or if Hale had prevailed upon his nephew to betray her after they married. In either case, the plan was so brazen, so sinister, that it was hard to fathom. It demanded that Ernest share a bed with Molly and raise children with her, all while plotting and scheming against her family. As Shakespeare wrote in Julius Caesar, "Where wilt thou find a cavern dark enough to mask thy monstrous visage? Seek none conspiracy. Hide it in smiles and affability." 16. For the Betterment of the Bureau. White and his men felt a growing sense of progress. A Justice Department prosecutor sent Hoover a note saying that in the few months since White had assumed command of the investigation, many new angles of these cases were successfully developed, and a new and enthusiastic spirit seemed to pervade the hearts of all of us. Still, White faced the same problem with the investigation of Molly Burkhart's murdered family that he did with his inquiry into Roan's death. There was no physical evidence or witnesses to prove that Hale had carried out or ordered any of the killings. And without an airtight case, White knew that he'd never be able to bring down this man who hid behind layers of respectability, who called himself the Reverend, and who used a network of patronage to influence the sheriff's office, prosecutors, judges, and some of the highest state officials. In a stark report, agents noted that Scott Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner and a guardian of Anna Brown and Lizzie, was a crook and evidently in the power of Hale. That an associate of Mathis's served as a spy for Bill Hale and the Big Hill Trading Company and does all the framing for them in their crooked deals in skinning the Indians. That the chief of police in Ponca City had taken money from Bill Hale. That the chief of police in Fairfax will do nothing against Hale whatsoever. That a local banker and guardian will not talk against the Hale faction for the reason that Hale has too much on him. That the mayor of Fairfax, an arch crook, was Hale's close friend. That a longtime county prosecutor was part of Hale's political machine and was no good and crooked. And that even a federal official with the Office of Indian Affairs was in the power of Bill Hale and will do what Hale says. White realized that his struggle to obtain justice was just beginning. As a bureau report would put it, Hale dominated local politics and seemingly could not be punished. Hoover had earlier praised White, saying that because of his handling of the case, conditions have been peaceful and I have had no complaint or criticism whatsoever, and this has been a great relief to me. Yet Hoover, that slender bundle of high-charged electric wire, as one reporter described him, was growing increasingly impatient. Hoover wanted the new investigation to be a showcase for his bureau, which he had continued to restructure. To counter the sordid image created by Burns and the old school of venal detectives, Hoover adopted the approach of progressive thinkers who advocated for ruthlessly efficient systems of management. These systems were modeled on the theories of Frederick Winslow Taylor, an industrial engineer, who argued that companies should be run scientifically, with each worker's task minutely analyzed and quantified. Applying these methods to government, progressives sought to end the tradition of crooked party bosses packing government agencies, including law enforcement, with patrons and hacks. Instead, a new class of technocratic civil servants would manage burgeoning bureaucracies in the manner of Herbert Hoover, the great engineer who had become a hero for administering humanitarian relief efforts so expeditiously during World War I. As the historian Richard Gid Powers has noted, J. Edgar Hoover found in progressivism an approach that reflected his own obsession with organization and social control. What's more, here was a way for Hoover, a desk-bound functionary, to cast himself as a dashing figure, a crusader for the modern scientific age. The fact that he didn't fire a gun only burnished his image. Reporters noted that the days of old sleuth are over, and that Hoover had scrapped the old gumshoe, dark lantern, and false mustache traditions of the Bureau of Investigation and substituted business methods of procedure. One article said, "He plays golf. Whoever could picture old sleuth doing that?" Yet, an ugliness often lurked beneath the reformist zeal of progressivism. Many progressives, who tended to be middle-class white Protestants, held deep prejudices against immigrants and blacks, and were so convinced of their own virtuous authority that they disdained democratic procedures. This part of progressivism mirrored Hoover's darkest impulses. As Hoover radically streamlined the Bureau, eliminating overlapping divisions and centralizing authority, White, like other special agents in charge, was given greater command over his men in the field, but he also became more accountable to Hoover for anything the agents did, good or bad. White had to constantly fill out efficiency rating sheets, grading agents on a scale of 0 to 100 in such categories as knowledge, judgment, personal appearance, paperwork, and loyalty. The average score became an agent's overall grade. After White told Hoover that he had occasionally given an agent a 100 rating, Hoover responded sharply, writing, "I regret that I am unable to bring myself to believe that any agent in the jurisdiction of the Bureau is entitled to a perfect or 100% rating." Hoover, who believed that his men should conquer their deficiencies the way he had conquered his childhood stutter, purged anyone who failed to meet his exacting standards. "I have caused the removal from the service of a considerable number of employees," he informed White and other special agents. "Some have been lacking in educational ability and others have been lacking in moral stamina." Hoover often repeated the maxim, "You either improve or deteriorate." Though Hoover conceded that some might deem him a fanatic, he reacted with fury to any violations of the rules. In the spring of 1925, when White was still based in Houston, Hoover expressed outrage to him that several agents in the San Francisco field office were drinking liquor. He immediately fired these agents and ordered White, who, unlike his brother Doc and many of the other cowboys, wasn't much of a drinker, to inform all his personnel that they would meet a similar fate if caught using intoxicants. He told White, "I believe that when a man becomes a part of the forces of this Bureau, he must so conduct himself as to remove the slightest possibility of causing criticism or attack upon the Bureau." The new policies, which were collected into a thick manual, the Bible of Hoover's Bureau, went beyond codes of conduct. They dictated how agents gathered and processed information. In the past, agents had filed reports by phone or telegram, or by briefing a superior in person. As a result, critical information, including entire case files, was often lost. Before joining the Justice Department, Hoover had been a clerk at the Library of Congress. "I'm sure he would be the chief librarian if he'd stayed with us," a co-worker said, and Hoover had mastered how to classify reams of data using its Dewey Decimal-like system. Hoover adopted a similar model, with its classifications and numbered subdivisions, to organize the Bureau's central files and general indices. Hoover's personal file, which included information that could be used to blackmail politicians, would be stored separately in his secretary's office. Agents were now expected to standardize the way they filed their case reports on single sheets of paper. This cut down not only on paperwork, another statistical measurement of efficiency, but also on the time it took for a prosecutor to assess whether a case should be pursued. White himself could be a demanding superior. An agent who worked under him in Oklahoma recalled that each of his men was supposed to know his job and do it. Another man who later worked under White said he could be honest till it hurt. Yet White was more forgiving of frailty than Hoover was, and he often tried to shield his men from the boss man's anger. When Hoover became inflamed after one of White's agents failed to use the one-page format in a report on the Osage murder cases, White told Hoover, "I feel that I, myself, am altogether to blame, for I looked over this report and gave it my approval." Under Hoover, agents were now seen as interchangeable cogs, like employees in a large corporation. This was a major departure from traditional policing, where lawmen were typically products of their own communities. The change helped insulate agents from local corruption and created a truly national force, yet it also ignored regional difference and had the dehumanizing effect of constantly uprooting employees. Speaking only with the betterment of the service in mind, White wrote to Hoover that he believed an agent who was familiar with the region and its people was more effective. He noted that one of his agents who had gone undercover as a Texas cattleman in the Osage case was ideally suited to working on the frontier. But put him in Chicago, New York, or Boston, and he is almost worthless. Hoover was unmoved. As one of his yes-men wrote in a memo, "I do not agree with Mr. White at all on this matter. An agent who is only acquainted with the characteristics of inhabitants of one section of the country had better get into some other line of work." At a makeshift training school in New York, agents were indoctrinated in the new regulations and methods. Hoover later turned the program into a full-fledged academy at Quantico, Virginia. Agents were increasingly trained in what Hoover hailed as scientific policing, such as fingerprint and ballistics techniques, and they were taught formal rules of evidence gathering in order to avoid cases being dropped or stalled, as had happened with the first Osage investigation. Some agents, especially older ones, despised Hoover and his edicts. One veteran agent advised new recruits, "The first thing you got to do is unlearn everything they taught you at the seat of government. The second is to get rid of those damn manuals." In 1929, an agent resigned with the complaint that Hoover's initiatives were directed against the personnel rather than against the criminal. White, too, sometimes chafed at Hoover's rules and whims. But he clearly relished being part of the Bureau, being swept up in events greater than himself. He tried to neatly type up his reports and touted the virtues of scientific policing. Later, he would replace his cowboy hat with a fedora and, like Hoover, take up golf, putting the ball across the immaculate greens where the new American men of money and power and leisure gathered. White would become almost indistinguishable from one of Hoover's college boys. 17. The Quick Draw Artist, the Yegg, and the Soup Man. During the fall of 1925, White tried to reassure Hoover that he'd gather enough evidence to put away Hale and his accomplices. White sent Hoover a memo reporting that an undercover operative was on Hale's ranch that very moment spying. White was feeling pressure, not just from Hoover. In the short time that White had been on the case, he had seen the lights burning each night around the homes of the Osage, and seen that members of the community wouldn't let their children go into town alone, and seen more and more residents selling their homes and moving to distant states or even other countries like Mexico and Canada. Later, one Osage called it a diaspora. The desperation of the Osage was unmistakable, as was their skepticism toward the investigation. What had the U.S. government done for them? Why did they, unlike other Americans, have to use their own money to fund a Justice Department investigation? Why had nobody been arrested? An Osage chief said, "I made peace with the white man and lay down my arms never to take them up again, and now I and my fellow tribesmen must suffer." White had come to understand that prejudiced and corrupt white citizens would not implicate one of their own in the killing of American Indians, and so he decided to change his strategy. He would try to find a source instead among the most disreputable, dangerous group of Oklahomans, the outlaws of the Osage Hills. Reports from agents and informants like Morrison suggested that several of these desperados had knowledge about the murders. These men might not be any less racist, but because some of them had recently been arrested or convicted of crimes, White would at least hold some leverage over them. The name of one outlaw in particular kept coming up. Dick Gregg, a 23-year-old stick-up man who used to run with the Al Spencer gang and who was now in a Kansas penitentiary serving a 10-year sentence for robbery. Gregg had once told Agent Berger that he knew something about the murders, though he remained coy, insisting that he couldn't betray a confidence. In a report, Agent Berger noted in frustration, "Gregg is 100% criminal and will tell as little as he can." Comstock, the attorney and guardian, knew Gregg's father well and provided legal counsel for the family. Hoover still didn't trust Comstock, but it was Comstock who used his relationship with Gregg's father to help persuade the young outlaw to cooperate with the Bureau. Eventually, White met with Gregg himself. White liked to take mental notes about the criminals he encountered in order to fix them in his memory, a skill honed from his time on the frontier when he could not rely on mugshots or fingerprints. Decades later, when White was asked to describe Gregg, he wrote with remarkable precision, "A very small man, I should say 5'6", and weighed 125 pounds, fair complexion, blue eyes, and light brown hair. A good-looking youngster." Gregg's pretty looks were deceiving, according to a prosecutor who said that he was a cold, cruel, calculating type of criminal who would not hesitate to commit murder. Still, in White's view, Gregg belonged to that category of outlaw who was not inherently bad and who might even have gone places with proper training. Though Gregg was known for his nerve as a stick-up man, he was reluctant to cross Hale. "If word got out," Gregg said, "my life would not be worth a damn." But hoping to shave time off his robbery sentence, he agreed to divulge to White and other agents what he knew. "Sometime in the summer of 1922, he recalled, "the outlaw, Al Spencer, told him that Hale wanted to meet with the gang, and so Spencer, Gregg, and several associates headed to one of Hale's pastures near Fairfax. Hale rode up fiercely on his horse, emerging from the tall prairie grasses. The group convened by the edge of a creek and shared some whiskey. Then Hale asked Spencer to step aside with him, and the two went off to talk. After they returned and the meeting broke up, Spencer relayed their conversation. Hale told Spencer that he'd pay him and his gang at least $2,000 to bump off a couple, an old man and his blanket, meaning an Indian woman. Spencer asked Hale whom he wanted dead. "Bill Smith and his wife," he said. Spencer told Hale that he might be cold-blooded, but he wouldn't kill a woman for silver. As he put it, "That's not my style." Hale said he hoped that Gregg at least would go through with the plan, but Gregg agreed with Spencer. White thought that Gregg was being on the level, and that his refusal to kill for hire showed him to be an outlaw with some honor. But though Gregg's testimony offered the clearest indication yet that Hale had ordered the murders, it was of limited legal value. After all, the statement was coming from a crook seeking to shorten his sentence, and Spencer, the one person who could corroborate Gregg's testimony, had since been gunned down by a posse of lawmen. The Pawhuska Daily Capital had reported, "With $10,000 bonds in one hand and Winchester clutched in the other, famous bandit dies in his boots, while hills which gave him shelter in life are his sepulcher in death." During one of his interrogations, Gregg said that agents should find Curly Johnson, an outlaw who ran with the stick-up man Blackie Thompson. "Johnson knows all about the Smith blow-up and will squeal if made to do so," Gregg promised. But Johnson, it turned out, was also rotting underground. Less than a year earlier, he died suddenly. Word was of poisoned alcohol. White's desperate search for a witness soon led him to Henry Grammer, the rodeo star and gun-slinging bootlegger who every year or so seemed to draw down on another man because of a dispute. "Henry Grammer shoots again," one headline put it. Though Grammer and Hale generally moved in different circles, White established that they'd known each other for years from the time when Hale had first appeared in Osage Territory at the turn of the century. In a rodeo contest in 1909, they'd competed with the Osage Cowboys against the Cherokee Cowboys. "Cherokee's no match for the Osage Ropers," declared the Muskogee Times Democrat. By 1925, Hale had shed his past, but there remained a faded photograph from the contest. It showed Hale and Grammer sitting proudly on their horses, holding up coiled ropes. Just before the Smith house blew up, Hale had told friends that he was heading out of town to attend the Fat Stock Show in Fort Worth, Texas. White looked into Hale's alibi and was told that Grammer had gone with him. A witness had overheard Hale talking to Grammer before the murders, murmuring something about being ready for that Indian deal. Like the other potential witnesses against Hale, however, Grammer was dead. On June 14, 1923, 3 months after the Smith's house was demolished, Grammer had been killed when his Cadillac spun out of control and flipped over. The legendary quick-draw artist had bled out on an empty country road. Finally, a yegg, a safecracker, gave White and his team the name of another witness to the bombing plot. Asa Kirby, the gold-toothed outlaw who had been an associate of Grammer's. The yegg said that Kirby was the soup man, the expert in explosives who had designed the bomb. But it turned out that Kirby couldn't testify either. A few weeks after Grammer's fatal car crash, he'd broken into a store in the middle of the night in an attempt to steal a stash of diamonds, only to find that the shopkeeper had been tipped off beforehand and was lying in wait with his 12-gauge shotgun. In an instant, Kirby was blasted into the world beyond. The person who had tipped off the shopkeeper about the robbery, White was hardly surprised to learn, was William K. Hale. By foiling the heist, Hale had reinforced his reputation for upholding law and order. But another outlaw told White that Hale had actually set up the robbery, that he told Kirby about the diamonds and suggested the ideal time to break in. It was evidently a plot within a plot, and White suddenly became suspicious of the litany of dead witnesses. He inquired about Grammer's car accident and was told by people who knew him that they believed his Cadillac steering wheel and brakes had been tampered with. Curly Johnson's widow, meanwhile, was sure that her husband had been murdered, intentionally poisoned by Hale and his henchmen. And when White learned about a potential witness in the Roan murder case, he discovered that this person had been bludgeoned to death. Anyone who could implicate Hale, it seemed, was being eliminated. The yegg said that Hale was taking care of too many people, adding, "I might be taking care of myself." Having failed to locate any living witnesses, White found himself stymied, and Hale seemed aware that agents were on to him. "Hale knows everything," the informant Morrison had told agents, and there were signs that Morrison might be playing his own duplicitous game. Morrison, agents learned, had told a friend that he had all the dope on the murders and had saved Hale's damned neck till now. Hale had begun spreading even more patronage to solidify his power. In a report, Agent Wren wrote that Hale was making all the propaganda he can to favor himself by giving presents, suits of clothes, as well as going on notes, providing loans, for different people. Hale was even giving ponies away to young boys. One of the undercover operatives who was playing a Texas cattleman had slowly become close with Hale. They shared stories about the old days cowboying, and the operative accompanied Hale as he inspected his herds of cattle. The operative reported that Hale seemed to be mocking investigators. Hale boasted to him, "I'm too slick and keen to catch cold." White would see Hale on the streets of Fairfax, with his bow tie on and his chin up, the incarnation of what White and his brothers and their father before them had spent their lives chasing. He carried himself, White thought, like he owned the world. Sometimes as the strain on White intensified, as each promising lead dead-ended, he would take his rifle and disappear into the countryside. Spotting a duck or some other flying prey, he would take aim and fire until the air was laced with smoke and blood drained into the soil. 18. The State of the Game. Out of the blue, White received a tip. In late October 1925, he was meeting with the governor of Oklahoma discreetly discussing the case. Afterward, an aide to the governor told White, "We've been getting information from a prisoner at McAllister, the state penitentiary, who claims to know a great deal about the Osage murders. His name is Bert Lawson. Might be a good idea to talk to him." Desperate for a new lead, White and Agent Frank Smith rushed over to McAllister. They didn't know much about Lawson, other than that he was from Osage County and that he had had several brushes with the law. In 1922, he had been charged with murdering a fisherman, but was acquitted after claiming that the fisherman had first come at him with a knife. Less than 3 years later, Lawson was convicted of second-degree burglary and sentenced to 7 years. White liked to interview a subject in a place that was unfamiliar to the person in order to unsettle him, and so he had Lawson taken to a room off the warden's office. White studied the man who appeared before him. Short, portly, and middle-aged, with ghostly white long hair. Lawson kept referring to White and Smith as the Hot Feds. White said to him, "We understand from the governor's office you know something about the Osage murders."
"I do," Lawson said, adding, "I want to make a clean breast of it."
In a series of interviews, Lawson explained that in 1918 he began working as a ranch hand for Bill Smith, and that he grew to know Hale and his nephews Ernest and Brian Burkhart. In a signed statement, Lawson said, "Sometime around the early part of 1921, I discovered an intimacy between my wife and Smith, which finally developed in breaking up my family and caused me to leave the employment of Smith." Ernest knew of Lawson's hatred of Smith, and more than a year later he visited him. Lawson recalled that Ernest turned to me and said, "Bert, I have got a proposition I want to make to you." I remarked, "What is it, Ernest?" Ernest said, "I want you to blow up and kill Bill Smith and his wife." When Lawson wouldn't agree to do it, Hale came to see him and promised him $5,000 in cash for the job. Hale told him that he could use nitroglycerin and that all he had to do was place a fuse under the Smith's house. Hale then pulled from his pocket, Lawson recalled, a piece of white fuse about 3 feet, and said, "I will show you how to use it." He then took his pocket knife and cut off a piece about 6 inches long, then took a match from his pocket and lighted the end. Lawson still said no, but shortly after he was arrested for killing the fisherman, Hale, who as a reserve deputy sheriff could come in and out of the jail as he pleased, visited him again and said, "Bert, you will be needing some attorneys pretty soon, and I know you haven't got any money to pay them with, and I want that job pulled." Lawson said, "All right, Bill, I'll pull it." One night not long after, Lawson recalled, another deputy sheriff opened his cell and led him to Hale, who was in a car outside. Hale drove Lawson to a building in Fairfax where Ernest was waiting. Hale told Ernest to get the box, and Ernest brought out a wooden container. Inside was a jug filled with nitroglycerin. A long, coiled fuse was attached to the spout. After carefully loading the box in the car, the three of them made their way to the Smith's house. "I got out and took the box and fuse, and Hale and Ernest drove on away," Lawson recounted. "I then went in the back way and into Smith's cellar, and placed the box in the far corner of the cellar, then laid the fuse out like Hale told me. I then sat down in the dark and waited." Lawson continued, "I saw the lights turned on. I suppose they all undressed and went to bed, for pretty soon the lights went out. I sat there for quite a while. I had no way to tell what time it was, but I would figure it was about 3/4 of an hour, and after I thought they were all asleep, I lighted a short piece of fuse. As soon as the long end began to smoke, I beat it as fast as I could." He could hear the house breaking apart. Hale and Ernest picked him up in a spot nearby and returned him to the jail, where the other deputy sheriff snuck him into his cell. Before Hale left, he'd warned Lawson, "If you ever cheat this to anybody, we will kill you." White and Agent Smith felt a rush of excitement. There were still questions. Lawson had not mentioned the involvement of Kirby, the soup man, but Kirby could have prepared the bomb for Hale without interacting with Lawson. White would need to tie up these loose ends, but at last a witness had emerged who could directly implicate Hale in the plot. On October 24, 1925, 3 months after White took over the case, he sent Hoover a telegram, unable to conceal a sense of triumph. "Have confession from Bert Lawson that he placed and set off the explosive that blew up Bill Smith's home. that he was persuaded, prompted, and assisted to do it by Ernest Burkhart and W.K. Hale. Hoover was elated. Via telegram, he quickly sent White a message. Congratulations. As White and his men worked to corroborate the details in Lawson's confession, they felt a growing urgency to get Hale and his nephews off the streets. The attorney and guardian Comstock, who White no longer doubted was helping investigators by persuading witnesses to talk, had begun to receive threats to his life. He was now sleeping in his office in downtown Pawhuska with his .44-caliber English bulldog by his side. Once when he went to open the window, he found sticks of dynamite behind the curtain, a relative recalled. He was able to dispose of them, but the relative added, Hale and his bunch were determined to kill him. White was also very concerned about the fate of Molly Burkhart. Although White had received reports that she was sick with diabetes, he was suspicious. Hale had successfully arranged, corpse by corpse, for Molly to inherit the majority of her family members' wealth. Yet the plot seemed unfinished. Hale had access to Molly's fortune through Ernest, but his nephew did not yet directly control it, and would do so only if Molly died and bequeathed it to him. A servant in Molly's house had told an agent that one night Ernest had muttered to her while drunk that he was afraid something would happen to Molly. Even Ernest seemed terrified of the plan's inevitable denouement. John Wren, the Ute agent, had recently spoken to Molly's priest, who said that she had stopped coming to church, which was unlike her, and that he had heard she was being forcibly kept away by family members. The priest was sufficiently alarmed that he had broken the tenet of parishioner confidentiality. Soon after, the priest reported that he had received a secret message from Molly. She was afraid that someone was trying to poison her. Given that poisoned whiskey had been one of the killer's preferred methods, the priest sent word back warning Molly not to drink any liquor of any kind under any circumstances. But Molly's diabetes seemed to have provided an even more devious way to deliver the poison. Some of the town's doctors, including the Schoen brothers, had been giving her injections of what was supposed to be insulin, but instead of improving, Molly seemed to be getting worse. Government officials working for the Office of Indian Affairs were also concerned that Molly was slowly being poisoned. A Justice Department official had noted that her illness is very suspicious, to say the least. It was urgent, the official went on, to get this patient to some reputable hospital for diagnosis and treatment free from the interference of her husband. By the end of December 1925, White felt that he could no longer wait. He had not finished confirming many details in Lawson's confession, and there remained certain contradictions. In addition to Lawson having made mention of Kirby, he had insisted that Hale was in Fairfax at the time of the explosion rather than in Fort Worth with Grammer, as some witnesses had claimed. Nevertheless, White rushed to obtain arrest warrants for Hale and Ernest Burkhart for the murders of Bill and Rita Smith and their servant Nettie Brookshire. The warrants were issued on January 4th, 1926. Because agents could not make arrests, they fanned out with U.S. Marshals and other lawmen, including Sheriff Frias, who, after being expelled from office, had been re-elected to the position. Several lawmen quickly located Ernest Burkhart at his favorite dive, a pool hall in Fairfax, and transported him to the jail in Guthrie, 80 miles southwest of Pawhuska. Hale, however, could not be found. Agent Wren learned that he had ordered a new suit of clothes and had said that he was planning to leave town at a moment's notice. Authorities feared that Hale had disappeared for good when he suddenly strolled into Sheriff Frias's office. He looked as if he were heading to a formal party. He wore a perfectly pressed suit, shoes shined to a gleam, a felt hat, and an overcoat with his diamond-studded Masonic lodge pin fastened to the lapel. "Understand I'm wanted," he said, explaining that he was there to turn himself in. No need to put the fellows out. As he was taken to the jail in Guthrie, he was confronted by a local reporter. Hale's deep-set eyes burned, and he moved, in the words of the reporter, like a leashed animal. The reporter asked him, "Have you a statement to make?" "What are you?" Hale demanded, not used to being questioned. "A newspaper man." "I'll not try my case in the newspapers, but in the courts of this county." Hoping Hale might at least talk about himself, the reporter asked, "How old are you?"
"I'm 51 years of age."
"How long have you been in Oklahoma?"
25 years, more or less."
"You're pretty well known, aren't you?"
"I think so."
"Have large numbers of friends?"
"I hope so."
"Wouldn't they like to have a statement from you, even though you merely say, 'I am innocent'?"
"I'll try my case in the courts, not in the newspapers. Cold tonight, isn't it?"
"Yes. How's the cattle business this season?"
"Been fair.
It's a long trip from Pawhuska, isn't it?"
"Yes, but we've had a car with curtains up."
"Now, about that statement?" Hale declined again and was led away by authorities. If Hale had momentarily been uneasy, he was confident by the time White spoke to him, even cocky, evidently convinced that he remained untouchable. He insisted that White had made a mistake. It was as if White were the one in trouble, not him. White suspected that Hale would never admit his sins, certainly not to a lawman and perhaps not even to the God whom he so often invoked. Ernest Burkhardt offered the only chance for a confession.
"You could look at him and size him up as the weak sister," White observed. A prosecutor working with White put it more bluntly.
"We all picked Ernest Burkhardt the one to break."
Burkhardt was brought into a room on the third floor of a federal building in Guthrie, which was being used as a makeshift interrogation room, the box. He was wearing the same clothes that he had when he was arrested, and White thought that he looked like a small-town dandy, well-dressed in a Western way, expensive cowboy boots, loud shirt, flashy tie, and a high-priced tailored suit. He moved about nervously and licked his lips. White and Agent Frank Smith questioned him.
"We want to talk to you about the murder of Bill Smith's family and Anna Brown," White said.
"Hell, I don't know a thing about it," Burkhardt insisted.
White explained that they had talked to a man named Bert Lawson in the pen who said differently. Said that Burkhardt knew a good deal about the murders. The mention of Lawson did not seem to faze Burkhardt, who insisted that he'd never had any dealings with him.
"He says you were the contact man in setting up the Smith House explosion," White said.
"He's lying," Burkhardt said emphatically.
A doubt seized White, a doubt that perhaps had been lurking somewhere inside him but had been suppressed. What if Lawson was lying and had simply picked up information from other outlaws in prison who had heard rumors about the case? Perhaps Lawson was lying in the hopes that prosecutors would reduce his jail time in exchange for his testimony. Or maybe the whole confession had been orchestrated by Hale, another one of his plots within a plot. White still didn't know quite what to believe. But if Lawson was lying about anything, getting a confession from Burkhardt was even more crucial, otherwise the case would collapse. For hours, in the hot, claustrophobic box, White and Smith went over the circumstantial evidence that they'd gathered on each of the murders, trying to trip up Burkhardt. White thought that he detected some element of remorse in him, as if he wanted to unburden himself to protect his wife and children. Yet whenever White or Smith mentioned Hale, he stiffened in his chair, more afraid of his uncle, it seemed, than he was of the law.
"My advice to you is to tell it all," White said, almost pleadingly.
"There's nothing to tell," Burkhardt said.
After midnight, White and Smith gave up and returned Burkhardt to his cell. By the next day, White's case encountered even more trouble. Hale announced that he could prove positively that he had been in Texas at the time of the explosion, for he had received a telegram there and signed for it. If this was true, and White was inclined to believe that it was, then Lawson had indeed been lying all along. In White's desperation to get Hale, he'd committed the ultimate sin of an evidence man and believed, despite apparent contradictions, what he wanted to believe. White knew that he had only hours before Hale's lawyers would produce the record of this telegram and spring Hale along with Burkhardt, only hours before word got out that the Bureau had humiliated itself, news that would then reach Hoover. As one of Hoover's aides said of the director, "If he didn't like you, he destroyed you." Hale's lawyers promptly tipped off a reporter who ran a story about Hale's perfect alibi, noting, "He's not afraid." A desperate White turned to the man who had embarrassed Hoover and become a pariah in the eyes of investigators, Blackie Thompson, the Park Cherokee outlaw who, during the Bureau's early investigation, had been released from prison as an informant only to murder a police officer. Since being caught, he'd been locked up at the state penitentiary, a blight on the Bureau best unseen. Yet from the Bureau's early reports on the case, White suspected that Blackie might have key information about the murders, and without consulting Hoover, White had him transported to Guthrie. If anything went wrong, if Blackie escaped or hurt a soul, White's career would be over. And White made sure that Luther Bishop, a state lawman who had gunned down Al Spencer, was in charge of transferring Blackie. When Blackie arrived at the federal building, he was in chains and flanked by a small army. On a nearby rooftop, White had placed a rifleman, who kept Blackie in his scope through a window. Blackie was still hostile, sullen, mean, but when White asked him about Hale and Burkhart's role in the murders of the Osage, his mood seemed to change. A man filled with venom and bigotry, he'd once complained that Hale and Ernest Burkhart were too much Jew. They want everything for nothing. Agents told Blackie that they couldn't cut a deal with him to reduce his sentence, and he spoke grudgingly at first about the murders, but gradually he divulged more and more. He said that Burkhart and Hale had once approached him and his old buddy Curly Johnson to kill Bill and Rita Smith. As part of the payment, they had proposed that Blackie steal Burkhart's car, and one night while Burkhart was at home in bed with Molly, Blackie had taken it from their garage. Blackie had later been picked up by the law for car theft and never went through with any of the killings. It wasn't clear if Blackie would ever agree to testify in court to these matters, but White hoped that he had enough information to save the case. He left Blackie surrounded by guards and rushed with Agent Smith to interrogate Burkhart again. Back in the box, White told Burkhart, "We're not satisfied with the answers you gave us last night. We believe there's a good deal you didn't tell us." "All I know is what's common talk," Burkhart said. White and Agent Smith played their last card. They told Burkhart that they had another witness who would testify to his involvement in the scheme to kill Bill and Rita Smith. Burkhart, knowing that he had been bluffed once, said that he didn't believe them. "Well, I can go get him if you don't think we've got him," Agent Smith said. "Bring him in," Burkhart said. White and Smith went and got Blackie and escorted him into the room. While the gunman on the roof kept Blackie in his scope through the window, the outlaw sat across from Burkhart, who looked stunned. Agent Smith turned to Blackie and said, "Blackie, have you told me the truth concerning the propositions made by Ernest Burkhart to you?" Blackie replied, "Yes, sir." Agent Smith added, "To kill Bill Smith?" "Yes, sir." "Did you tell me the truth when you told me Ernest gave you an automobile as part payment of that job?" "Yes, sir." Blackie, evidently enjoying himself, looked squarely at Burkhart and said, "Ernest, I've told him everything." Burkhart appeared defeated. After Blackie was taken away, White thought that Burkhart was ready to confess and turn on Hale, but each time Burkhart came close to doing so, he stopped himself. Around midnight, White left Burkhart in the custody of the other agents and returned to his hotel room. There were no more tricks to play. Exhausted, despairing, he collapsed on his bed and fell asleep. Not long after, White was jolted awake by the phone. Facing the prospect that something else had gone wrong, that Blackie Thompson had sprung loose, he picked up the receiver and heard the urgent voice of one of his agents. "Burkhart's ready to tell his story," he said, "but he won't give it to us, says it's got to be you." When White entered the box, he found Burkhart slumped in his seat, tired and resigned. Burkhart told White that he hadn't killed all those people, but he knew who had. "I want to tell," he said. White reminded Burkhart of his rights, and Burkhart signed a paper that said, "After being so warned, and with no promises having been made me of immunity from prosecution, and of my own free will and accord, I now make the following statement." Burkhart began speaking about William Hale, about how he had worshipped him as a boy, how he had done all types of jobs for him, and how he had always followed orders. "I relied on Uncle Bill's judgment," he said. "Hale was a schemer," Burkhart said, "and though he hadn't been privy to all the mechanics of Hale's plots, his uncle had shared with him details of a murderous plan to kill Rita and Bill Smith." Burkhart said that he had protested when Hale had informed him of his intention to blow up the whole house and everyone in it, including his own relatives. Hale told him,
"What do you care? Your wife will get the money."
Burkhart said that he went along with Hale's plan, as he always did. Hale had first approached the outlaws Blackie Thompson and Curly Johnson to do the bloodletting. In a later statement, Burkhart recalled,
"Hale had told me to see Curly Johnson and find out how tough he was and if he wanted to make some money, and told me to tell Johnson the job was to bump a squaw man,"
referring to Bill Smith. Then, when Johnson and Blackie couldn't do the job, Hale sought out Al Spencer. After Spencer refused, Hale spoke to the bootlegger and rodeo star Henry Grammer, who promised to provide a man for the job.
Just a few days before the blow-up happened, Grammer told Hale that Asa
Kirby,
would do it, Burkhart recalled. "That is what Hale told me." Burkhart said that Lawson had nothing to do with the explosion, explaining, "You've got the wrong pig by the tail." Later, Lawson admitted to White,
"All that story I told was a lie. All I know about the Smith blow-up was just what I heard in jail. I done wrong and lied."
In fact, Burkhart indicated that Hale had gone with Grammer to Fort Worth so they would have an alibi. Before leaving, Hale told Burkhart to deliver a message to John Ramsey, the cow thief and bootlegger who worked for Henry Grammer. The message was for Ramsey to tell Kirby that it was time to carry out the job. Burkhart delivered the message and was home with Molly on the night of the explosion.
"When it happened, I was in bed with my wife," he recalled. "I saw a light on the north side. My wife went to the window and looked out. She said that she thought somebody's house was on fire. As soon as she said that, I knew what it was."
Burkhart also provided crucial details about how Hale had arranged the murder of Roan for the insurance money.
"I know who killed Henry Roan," Burkhart said, and he identified Ramsey, the cow thief, as the trigger man.
The case had broken wide open. White placed a call to Agent Wren, who was out in the field.
"There's a suspect up there named John Ramsey," White told him. "Take him into custody right away."
Ramsey was picked up and brought into the box. He wore overalls over his tall, thin frame. His black hair was greasy, and he walked with a slight, menacing limp. A reporter said he seemed like a nervy and perhaps a dangerous man. According to the accounts of White and other agents, he looked at the agents warily, insisting he didn't know a thing. Then White laid Burkhart's signed statement in front of Ramsey, who stared at the paper as if trying to assess its authenticity. Just as White and Smith had presented Burkhart with Blackie, they now brought in Burkhart to confirm his statement to Ramsey. And Ramsey threw up his hands and said,
"I guess it's on my neck now. Get your pencils."
According to his sworn statement and other testimony, sometime in early 1923, Grammer told Ramsey that Hale had a little job he wanted done. When Ramsey asked what it was, Grammer said that Hale needed an Indian knocked off. Ramsey, who referred to the plot as the state of the game, eventually agreed, and he lured Roan down into the canyon, promising him whiskey.
"We sat on the running board of his car and drank," Ramsey recounted. "The Indian then got in his car to leave, and I then shot him in the back of the head. I suppose I was within a foot or two of him when I shot him. I then went back to my car and drove to Fairfax."
White observed the way Ramsey kept saying "the Indian" rather than Roan's name. As if to justify his crime, Ramsey said that even now, white people in Oklahoma thought no more of killing an Indian than they did in 1724. White still had questions about the murder of Molly's sister, Anna Brown. Ernest Burkhart remained cagey about the role of his brother Brian, evidently not wanting to implicate him. But he revealed the identity of the mysterious third man who had been seen with Anna shortly before her death. It was someone whom the agents knew all too well. Kelsey Morrison, their undercover informant, who had supposedly been working with the agents to identify the third man. Morrison had not just been a double agent who had funneled information back to Hale and his henchmen. It was Morrison, Ernest said, who had put the fatal bullet in Anna Brown's head. While the authorities went to round up Morrison, they also made sure that a doctor went to check on Molly Burkhart. She seemed near death, and based on her symptoms, authorities were certain that someone had been secretly poisoning her and doing it slowly so as not to arouse suspicions. In a later report, an agent noted, "It is an established fact that when she was removed from the